Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good Thursday morning. Thanks for listening to the show here on 91.5 KJZZ. In Phoenix with Lauren Gilger, I'm Steve Goldstein. Coming up this hour, an APS executive addresses potential policy reforms and assessing the challenges of women in policing.
Firefighters battling the museum fire burning just north of Flagstaff got some help yesterday from monsoon rains, a welcome relief from the dry and windy conditions they have been experiencing. But now concerns are turning to potential flooding. The fire has consumed some 1,800 acres so far and was contained by only 12% at last check. And here to give us the latest on all of this is KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins, who is in Flagstaff now. Jimmy, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Lauren.
So what is the latest? Is that number still correct, only 12% contained?
Yeah, those numbers are still about the same, a little more than closer to 1,900 acres, about 12 or 13% contained is what the latest numbers are telling us.
And how much did the rains that you guys got up there in Flagstaff yesterday help? Is this really going to make a dent?
Yeah, actually, we got some more information on that last night at the community meeting at Coconino High School. Some of the fire officials told us that because of the rain, they were actually allowed to do more aggressive things like establish fire lines and kind of go in and sort of attack certain areas that they wanted to work on. So, yes, with regard to that, they say it's helping them fight the fire. Hasn't been a lot of rain, so that's good because it hasn't triggered any flooding yet, but also not quite enough to, you know, really start to extinguish things.
What do the weather conditions look like going forward? Are we looking at any more rain or drier and windier conditions?
Yes, the National Weather Service officials told us last night that, you know, since we are in monsoon here, we are expecting more rain over the next couple days. Just as I look up around me, it's cloudy skies, looking dark toward the peaks. And, you know, the weather patterns up here are so incredible. Just yesterday, they had a couple extreme downpours on, you know, one side of a slope, another side of a slope. So they're monitoring things closely. But the areas that they're concerned about, they do believe will receive some rain over the next few days.
Mm-hmm. And give us a sense, like you're standing in Flagstaff and you can pretty much see where this is burning, right? How close is this to where people are living?
Yeah, well, just to give you a sense, like last night when we were all at Coconino High School, the helicopters that were dumping the buckets of water were just, you know, two ridges over. The police and fire have cordoned off a lot of roads, but I was able to kind of work my way around some back roads last night, Lauren, and I was able to get close to the fire. And, you know, it's within, you know, half mile of a lot of nice homes, a lot of different areas out here. So this is really on people's doorstep.
Are people under evacuation notice at this point still?
There were several hundred residents that were evacuated and allowed to return yesterday. So no, currently no one is evacuated, but they're all in that sort of set stage where they could be asked to leave again if conditions change. And everyone, as I've been driving around, you know, everyone's putting up sandbags around their homes, trying to kind of direct water down the mountain away from their property.
Right. So let's talk more about that. Why are concerns turning to flooding at this point?
Because this is something that they have gone through here before. They specifically talked to us about how in 2010, the Schultz fire was so severe, the flooding afterwards was so severe that they got a lot of really good data that they've been working with. And this fire scar is going to be similar to that fire scar, which means they can kind of figure out where the water is going to drain and flow. So they're using that data to help people get ready, help people be prepared. You know, they're talking about what a fire does to the ground. It can actually kind of turn it into like a glassy substance, which increases the speed of the water and potential debris flows.
Yeah. So last question for you before I let you go. Have you gotten a chance to talk to some of the people up there, and how are people feeling about this?
lot of people are concerned, obviously. A lot of people were relieved. I talked to a couple of people who got to go back to their homes yesterday. So, you know, a lot of people in the sunny side area are, you know, happy to be back in their neighborhoods, but at the same time, very tense. I think they're just kind of waiting hour by hour. A lot of people I talked to said they're kind of just refreshing weather apps. And then the other thing that kind of shows the heightened sense of awareness, the whole time we were at this meeting last night, those emergency alerts kept going off on everyone's phone, and everyone really is on constant alert here. And for good reason. This is could be, you know, serious danger. After we get through the one danger of the fire, everyone needs to be on alert for the potential flooding that's coming. And so I think everyone's taking the necessary steps, but definitely a heightened sense of awareness here.
All right, that's KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins joining us from Flagstaff, where the museum fire is burning. Jimmy, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Lauren.
The state's largest utility, Arizona Public Service, has faced intense criticism from some circles over the past few months. Some of that is related to a revisited rate case from 2017, when more customers than expected found they were going to be paying higher bills. But most of it revolves around the deaths of two APS customers, who had their power turned off in the midst of hot weather because they were behind on payments. Since then, the Corporation Commission has implemented a moratorium on the shutoff policy that'll extend until October 15th. In the meantime, APS is working on reassessing some of its own policies, and with me to talk about that is Daniel Fretcher, Executive Vice President of Operations. He has been with APS for 39 years. Daniel, what are your thoughts about the Corporation Commission taking action on this shutoff policy, and have changes been in the works within APS?
I guess we'll start with, you know, there was a New Times article that emerged alleging that there was a correlation between an electric service non-paid disconnect and the death of a customer. Any death, any loss of life, tragic, and it certainly got our attention, and it got the commission's attention. The company, Steve, suspended then disconnect activity first, and within a few days, the commission took a broader approach for all electric utilities across the state and suggested, in fact, mandated no more disconnects through mid-October. We don't have any issue with that. You know, this situation, while it's complicated, clearly points to a need for multiple entities, the community as a whole, to take a look at then summertime heat, service requirements, service policies, those kinds of things. So we don't have any objection to the steps the commission took, and in fact support it. I think it was the right thing to do, and glad that they did. We've got some work to do then with the commission and, frankly, with our customers. There could be some unintended consequences coming out the back door in mid-October that we need to be aware of, and the collective we with our customers and our regulatory body need to work through such that we do not place customers in a position coming out in mid-October within which there are balances carried forward that then create service jeopardy and puts us back in the same place, albeit in a different season.
Take me where we've been, at least. If I'm an APS customer, mm-hmm. and I get a notice that I'm behind on payment and shutoff may be in the offing, how does the company handle that at that point? And then if I do get shut off, what's some of the process to that now? And then if you want to make changes going forward, what do you think those look like?
It's not as condensed or as black and white a situation as most people would think, meaning we are in the service business. It's in our name. And these are our customers. So we're not in the business of disconnecting power. It's a little bit contrary to the business model, if you will. And we care about these people. Okay, this is our community. Those 6,300 employees live here. All of that, I think you can appreciate. Customer receives a bill, does not pay it. Customer receives a second bill. First bill is past due, and that's noticed on the bill. You're past due. Here's the due date. No payment or contact to the company for payment arrangements, and an independent shutoff notice with a shutoff date is then mailed to the customer's home. No payment, no contact for payment arrangements. A predictive dialer, a phone call initiated by the company, is then made to the customer indicating what the shutoff date is. Again, encouraging payment arrangements, so on and so forth. No contact. We then dispatch an individual who will leave a door hanger at the customer premise. They don't collect money. There are other risks associated with that, but it's the final notice, if you will, a visit to the premise indicating that We either need payment or we'd like to talk about payment arrangements. And failing any communication, then the service is subject to disconnect. So it's a lengthy process. There are multiple touch points initiated by the company. You asked where I started with APS. I started as a credit representative in our phone center, working with customers in the early 1980s, making credit arrangements for our customers. It's our intent to work with people, not to disconnect their service. And so those touch points are intended to get us together, seek arrangements, make referrals to crisis bill assistance or other social service agencies that might be able to lend some support, and to figure out a way, Steve, in simple terms, how do we make this work such that the service can be maintained and some logical path to keep the company and the customer in equilibrium can be figured out.
When I think about even what you said about perhaps a safety issue if someone tried to demand payment or collect payment, I get that. Is it a feeling, though, especially, again, I'm thinking seasonally, to do a little bit more and actually try to make actual contact with a person? How much responsibility do you think lies with APS? How much with the individual customer?
Our outreach, multiple touch points, I described them. Is it adequate? Is it sufficient? I think that's the very discussion now that APS, the other electric utilities, the Corporation Commission, social service agencies, maybe the legislature, maybe the governor's office. Anyway, this is a community issue, and if something good has come from this, it is that the dialogue now is front and center, and there's a recognition that this is a community/societal issue. The absence of a safety net or a full safety net for our most vulnerable constituents and customers is something we collectively need to address. So that's the good side out of this unwanted event that I think it'll mobilize all of us, and we'll be better for it.
One other issue that had popped up had to do with the Corporation Commission dealing with rate increase that APS had asked for and received. And there was concern among some customers that they didn't get enough information about whether they were going to see a decrease or an increase. Did the company handle that right from the standpoint that it did seem to be a greater number of people than they had expected to see their rates go up?
Yeah, it's a tough one, and for a couple of reasons. You're referencing an increase in prices from August of 2017. The interesting part is it wasn't a flat 4.5% across all customers. Concurrent with that is we enacted, with commission support and a lot of stakeholder support, 29 parties who signed on to a settlement agreement off of that particular rate case, moving customers to a new menu of rates that in many cases have pricing components that encourage certain behaviors to help all of us from an energy conservation, energy efficiency, utilization of electricity standpoint. When you move 1.1 million residential customers from an existing rate to a new rate, and embedded in that is a change in prices, you've got a set of dynamics, frankly, that no utility in the country had ever faced before. Did we do it well? I am proud of my people. I think we did it exceptionally well. However, if from a customer perspective, we didn't achieve what we needed to achieve, then we didn't do it well enough. And I think that's the commission's point of view, and we'll accept that criticism. And we are working with them now to map out a path going forward within which continuing customer education about rates, rate options, energy conservation, energy efficiency, opportunities to save, all those kinds of things can be a regular part of our communications cadence, if you will, with our customers.
Does seem like a lot of the things we keep coming back to are communication and getting to a point of where nothing's 100%, but you can get there as close as possible. Because I sort of keep hearing you're doing it well, but you know you can do it better. How hard is it to get to that better step?
It's again a good question, and humbly, the best I can tell you is I am proud of my company, and I am proud of my colleagues. But I also know that we can do better. The monthly electricity bill is also not often the top-of-mind issue with our customers. And so we have to remember that three outreach efforts or four or five or six multiple touch points, people are not living and breathing and we're not top-of-mind. And so we've got to work harder. We've got to work harder. We've got to work harder. And we've got to be more creative in terms of getting important information in front of our customers.
Daniel Fretcher is Executive Vice President of Operations for Arizona Public Service. Appreciate you coming in. Thanks.
Thanks for the opportunity.
as Maricopa County Attorney Bill Montgomery gears up for his second run at the Arizona Supreme Court, his opponents are keeping up their campaign against him. The ACLU of Arizona will lead a protest outside of his office today ahead of his interview with the Commission on Appellate Court Appointments. They're aiming to drive home concerns about his potential to become Justice Montgomery. High Ground's Doug Cole served on the commission for 6 years, and he joins us now to talk about Montgomery's ongoing bid to join the highest court in the state. Welcome to the show, Doug.
Good morning.
So let's start with your time on the commission. Give us a sense of how it functions and how it may function in this case.
Sure. And thanks for having me on the show this morning. It's a very important constitutional commission that was set up by voters in the early 1970s. Arizona went from direct election of judges to a merit selection in the two biggest counties. And it says any county that gets over 250,000 in population then moves into the merit selection. So currently we have Maricopa, Pima, Pinal, which joined about 8-10 years ago, and then Coconino voted themselves into the merit selection system. That's the first county to do that. They did that the last election. So in all these counties, there's a commission that is appointed by the governor and is confirmed by the Arizona State Senate. Each commission has 15 members, 10 are public members, of which I was one, mm-hmm. and then they have five attorney members, and then a Supreme Court justice serves as a non-voting chairman. So you have the Maricopa Commission on trial court appointments that does the Superior Court, the Pima Commission, the Pinal Commission, and now the Coconino Commission. Then you have the big commission, which is the Appellate Court Commission. That's also 15 members. 10 public and five attorneys. That picks the Division I and Division II appellate court judges and the Supreme Court vacancies.
Now, Doug, considering how we're talking about merit selection, and merit selection requires the governor to see candidates not just from his own party.
That's correct.
In essence, how could this possibly work in this case? How influential is the commission ultimately when the governor gets the final call? They give him the list of selections, but then what, they've done their job at that point.
That's correct. And merit is the key word. It's the commission's job not to try to put a list together to force the governor's hand. Their job is to take applicants, look at their qualifications, and see if they have the merit to be selected by the governor.
And in this case, as we look at Bill Montgomery, is this going to how is the commission going to affect that decision at this point?
So, and on top of merit, the commission's hands are tied constitutionally on what those lists can look like. So, it says no more than 60% can be of the same party. So, if you're going to send up a list of three, then two can only be of the same party, one from not of that party. If you're going to send up a list of five, three can be Republican, two can be of other party. If you're going to send up a list of seven, four can be Republican, and three can be from other party. And in this case, of the nine that have applied, six of them are Republican, two of them are Democrats, and one is a Libertarian. So the governor, in this case, if the commission decides to send up all three that are not Republicans, he can send up a list of seven, okay, unlike last round. Mm-hmm. They sent up a list of five because they only had two non-Republicans.
I need you to be brief on this one, Doug. So,
sure.
So we're thinking about Bill Montgomery's the big name we're hearing. Is it odd that there would be supporters that would be that open about sort of lobbying the commission, in a sense?
Well, yeah, that's kind of unusual because if you look at the normal applicant pool for the Supreme Court, that's the two Court of Appeals divisions. Most of the applicants that move up to the Supreme Court have served on the Court of Appeals in either the Tucson Division, which is two, and Division I here in Phoenix. So it's unusual to have an elected official, especially a very high-profile elected mm-hmm. official like Bill Montgomery, apply. So what does that mean? His record is out there for all to like or to dislike. And as we know today, there's going to be a protest by the ACLU. This isn't the first time the ACLU has gone after Montgomery. They're actually suing him right now over public records.
Yeah. All right. That's Doug Cole with High Ground. Doug, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Next month, Phoenix voters will decide on two ballot measures. One of them, Proposition 106, is connected to one of the city's more difficult challenges, pension costs. The pension-related debt is several billion dollars in total. Phoenix is far from alone as a city needing to take other steps related to pensions, but it has instituted reforms in recent years. For supporters of Proposition 106, which they're calling the Responsible Budget Act, an additional needed reform has to do with limiting city spending until much more is done about paying down the pension-tied debt. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a Prop 106 opponent. I begin with supporter Marissa Hamilton. She's a spokesperson for Responsible Budgets. All right, Marissa, why should Phoenix residents vote for Prop 106?
Well, the city of Phoenix has made some promises to our retirees, and we're in a position where we're in a bit of a crisis. Pew Research says that we have the third largest unfunded liabilities out of 61 cities that they've been tracking. And I don't think that the voters really understand the position that we're putting our retirees in. So those are promises that we've made. And when those checks go to get cash, they're essentially going to bounce. So we need the Responsible Budgets Initiative so that we can make sure that we can keep those promises.
And what specifically would it do? What specifically would it limit?
So it's going to, one, require an annual review of the pension debt, and it's going to require to use normal business GAAP standard accounting practices. So the important piece in that is that the city can no longer hide the debt. So everyone knows what the debt's going to be now going forward. We'll be able to know how much of the pension is funded. So until the pensions are 90% funded, it's going to basically put a cap on the budget. And so it's going to require a balanced budget. And so with the exception of emergency type services like fire and police and whatnot, it will require that until the pensions are 90% funded, all the surplus in the budget goes to pay off the pensions. If you think of it like a credit card with a high interest rate, that's essentially the approach that it takes.
And is this the approach because otherwise we're going to go off a cliff?
Yeah, absolutely. We're actually already there. We're actually already at the point that so much of our budget is going to pensions that as citizens look around and they look at their roads crumbling or infrastructure not being kept up, and they wonder, where's all the money going? Well, it's going to the pensions. And so because our budget hasn't been balanced, and every single year there's so much waste that we end up spending on. And they're cute little projects at the time, right? But when it comes to, okay, do you want your roads to be maintained or do you want these cute little projects? And it all adds up at the end of the day. So the three options that are going to happen if we don't have responsible budgets is eventually the city's going to have to raise taxes substantially. It's going to hurt everyone, not just the rich people. It will hurt everyone. We're going to need to cut services significantly. And we're already kind of starting to see that because really our roads especially should be taken care of better than they already are. We had a 12% increase on water taxes to build some infrastructure. But if we had been managing our budget properly, we probably would have had the funds to cover some of that. And then the third thing that will happen is insolvency, which no one likes. That's basically bankruptcy. That's where the cities go to court and the city hashes out what retirement benefits look like. And that's where it ends up being that we can't keep our promises to our retirees.
Has something similar to this approach been used in any other cities that are struggling with pension problems?
No, this is going to be the first city for responsible budgets. And so that's the reason why it's something that I'm so excited about, because just bringing that transparency, bringing that responsibility as far as making sure that your budget is balanced and that you're paying off that pension debt, that's so critical to be able to solve the problem. The initiative itself doesn't solve the problem 100%, but it sets up a level playing field so that, one, the city and the citizens know where we stand, and we're able to solve it going forward.
And how does this affect elected officials?
So for elected officials, this is my favorite part. It kills pensions for politicians. And so we should be clear in the fact that our city council members are part-time employees. So they're not there full-time. And so although most of them do a fantastic job, they have left us with this burden. And so it cuts their pensions going forward. Prior promises made to them will still be kept, but going forward, it will cut their pensions. And a lot of people in the private sector, don't even get pensions. So when they find out that our politicians work part-time and they get pensions for life, they're like, what is going on?
Many people would say, for example, that the Chamber of Commerce is at least a right-leaning, if not a conservative organization. Right-leaning, I think, is pretty safe to say. And there have been some concerns the Chamber of Commerce has expressed. What does that say to you?
the initiative really is more of a balanced initiative. There's some things that both sides of the aisle can be excited about. Like the right side of the aisle is going to be excited about killing pensions for politicians, right? The left side of the aisle and a lot of the right is going to be excited that we're keeping those promises to our retirees, especially to our first responders. So it's better that we take responsibility now, we provide this extra transparency, and we make sure that we are, one, arming our citizens and our voters with the right information going forward so that we can make better decisions.
Marissa Hamilton of Responsible Budgets, yes on 106. Marissa, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
Proposition 106 has a long list of opponents, including Arizona's AFL-CIO. And with me to talk about why he's against the measure is Joseph Witt. He belongs to Ask Me Local 2960, a union that represents City of Phoenix employees. Joseph, why are you against the proposition?
We're against this because this would just be a detriment to the economy for the City of Phoenix, now that it's just now started to get its feet underneath them after the last 10 years. And this would just take everything away that we've already earned back.
Does this tie the hands of the city in terms of needing to spend on a certain thing because it would not be related to pension? Give me a little more detail on it.
Yeah, it would handcuff the city council on what they could do with the money that they make. If they get a flush economy and they make more money, it would go towards the public safety retirement system, which is a state-run retirement system for the Phoenix Fire Department and the Phoenix Police Department. I'm all for my brothers and sisters over there of getting a good pension. However, I don't think that city tax dollars should go to a state retirement fund. You know, it doesn't make any sense. Then it would go to what I belong to as a City of Phoenix employee, which is called COPRS, City of Phoenix Employee Retirement System. Both are funded at 60% currently. I know for civilians, we are at three different tiers. In reality, it's two. We have those where I've been with the city for 18 years, I put in 5%. Those hired after a certain date put in 11%. And then the third tier is also 11%. Now, the middle tier at one point was putting in 15%. Had the unions not gotten with city council at the time and Mayor Greg Stanton at the time, they would have continued to put a 15% in. And those employees with the city that were making $10 an hour were not really making $10 an hour. So financially, that was really crippling them. They were making more like $7 an hour.
So there has been action taken by the city when it comes to pension reform. Is there an alternative? Is there something that maybe you'd like to see the council act on that may improve that situation that doesn't involve this proposition?
I think they've already done it. With the 11% contribution that employers are putting in, those of us like me are retiring. We are the rule of 80, age plus years of service. Though they are now rule of 87, so now they're making them work even longer before they can even obtain their pension. But I think we're good right now. May it need be adjusted in the future? Absolutely. Everything needs to be relooked at over generations as we go. Cost of living really hampers a lot of things when it comes to that. So it's going to be a cost of doing business is going to increase as well. So, yeah, I think that we're right where we need to be right now. I don't think that Prop 106 will salvage that. One of the factors in this is that any contracts, and that's for any labor contracts, even though it says it doesn't hamper them, it would revert us back to anything that was agreed upon before January of 2018, which puts us in a recession contract. So they would take away everything that we just obtained. On top of that, there's a percentage of the budget that went not only to the City of Phoenix. Now, the lion's share always goes to employees. Labor is a cost, and that's a cost that everybody has to take in, right? The rest of it went towards funding for libraries so they can get their Sundays back. Mm-hmm. They can hire more guards. They can hire more librarians. Pool extent hours were cut short during the recession and during the last 10 years. They'll be able to increase those now because of the funds that have been coming to the City of Phoenix. So that would all go away and be worse than what it was pre-session days. And who wants that?
So what do you make of this timing and why it's been brought about? Does that get your antenna up a little bit?
It does. Actually, Sal DeCicco started this last year. In January of 2018 is when we first heard about it. The city charter allows 2 years to gather signatures. So they paused for a while we went through the midterm elections last year and then took it up again this year. Now, the issue I have with that, and these are actual members that have been approached by signature gatherers, mm-hmm. They came up with the false of being, this is going to help police and fire pensions, and this is going to stop elected officials getting a pension. Okay, well, that's 9 people. Okay, it doesn't revert back to the former mayors or former city council members that are getting a pension from the city, just the current nine that are sitting there right now. So nine people, that's really not going to put a dent in the elected officials' pensions. So what his thought process is, I don't know. Sal DiCicco has never really been a friend of public employees. He usually, when he tries to do something nice, we're skeptical. I mean, I have nothing against the man. He's a politician. He's doing his job that he feels that he should be doing for his constituents. I can't fault him for that. Do I want the city to be fiscally sound? Absolutely. Who doesn't? Because if the city's fiscally sound, that means that we can attract more employees, keep the ones that we have that are doing well, and be a good city. Maybe we can get back to one of the best-run cities again, because we're not at that point right now.
Well, Joseph Witt, thanks for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Joseph Witt is part of a coalition opposed to Proposition 106. Election Day in Phoenix is August 27th, with early ballots going out July 31st.
Good morning. This is the show here on KJZZ. I'm Lauren Gilger along with Steve Goldstein. And if you are noticing that it is pretty sticky out there, it is monsoon season officially. And that means this is time for our summer series, Monsoon Stories. For this, we need your help. This year, we're telling stories about how the monsoon storms awaken our senses, how they look, feel, sound, smell, even taste. There are lots of ways to interpret these, obviously. And we're hearing some really great stories so far. So if you want to join in, there are plenty of ways to participate. Go to monsoon.kjzz.org and find out how.
Hundreds of business leaders across the country are urging lawmakers in D.C. to sign the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, the USMCA, into law. This is the agreement that would replace the 25-year-old NAFTA and open the doors for smoother trade among the three countries. Today, leading industry associations joined U.S. Chamber CEO Thomas Donahue in a press conference to once again put pressure on Congress to pass the deal. And joining us for just a couple of minutes to talk about more is John Murphy, Senior Vice President for International Policy at the U.S. Chamber. Thomas, thanks for being with us. I'm sorry, John. Thanks for being with us. John, let me ask you one quick question to start off with, which is, this seemed like something that could have somewhat smooth sailing with bipartisan agreement. What's the holdup right now, and what are you concerned about?
So I think you're fundamentally right that this is has the potential to be a bipartisan win. What's going on right now is that the trade agreement, which was concluded late last year, has gone through the usual review. There was an economic impact study to assess its benefits. That came out well. We've been moving through those procedures. But House Democrats, Speaker Pelosi and others, have said that there's a handful of issues where they're not quite satisfied. It's a limited list, and there are ongoing conversations between Speaker Pelosi and a working group of eight House Democrats who are meeting regularly with the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative to try and address those. They involve things like enforcement and labor and environment. And we're optimistic that they'll reach a kind of a deal and find a way to address those concerns. And then in September, when Congress comes back to town, we'll be able to move forward.
And why was this important to you to begin with, John? Like, give us a sense of the updates, the things that are new in this that you think need to go into place soon.
Well, this agreement will do two things. It will preserve and strengthen our trade with Canada and Mexico, which are by far our most important trading partners. And that's certainly true for Arizona. We've seen trade grow to the point that 12 million American jobs depend on trade with these two countries. They buy more U.S.-made manufactured goods than the next 11 countries on the list combined. They're that important. And so USMCA will hold on to the nearly entirely tariff-free access that American exporters have to Mexico and Canada, but it'll also modernize trade rules. There's a modernized intellectual property chapter. There's a landmark digital trade chapter. These things didn't really exist on this level back 25 years ago when NAFTA was negotiated. So this is really bringing trade and trade rules into the 21st century.
John, I apologize. Only a few seconds left for this question. But with the way the Trump administration has handled trade in general, with the president talking about tariffs and whatnot, has that turned out to be a concern in any way as far as making progress on this agreement, which, as we said, should have been a little bit more of a no-brainer?
Well, the threat to impose tariffs on Mexico a few weeks ago threw a monkey wrench in the gears. The good news is that didn't happen, and it looks like it's not going to happen. So if anything, it underscores the value of a trade agreement like that, this, which provides the certainty that American companies and farmers and ranchers that they need to be able, that they're going to be able to continue to access customers in Mexico and Canada. So if anything, it makes the agreement even more important.
All right. John Murphy, Senior Vice President for International Policy at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. We appreciate a few minutes of your time.
Thank you.
Transgender people face a unique set of challenges when they are held in federal detention, and those issues are in the spotlight as the migrant crisis continues along the U.S.-Mexico border. Now, 29 transgender women are sounding the alarm. They are being held at the Cibola County Correctional Facility in New Mexico in a unit specifically designated for transgender women. In an open letter handwritten in Spanish, the 29 women claim they are being repeatedly abused by guards on multiple levels. Our feelings are worries, our indignation, the violation of our rights, our vulnerability before ICE and the officials that work here, they write. For all of these reasons, we are expressing ourselves not just as trans women, but also as human beings. The allegations in the letter include inadequate medical attention, including those who are HIV positive, as well as fear of retaliation for speaking out. Carla Bautista Chonet is an activist with Trans Queer Pueblo, a group that advocates for transgender undocumented migrants. She's also a transgender woman and immigrant from Guatemala who has been held in immigration detention herself. I spoke with her through a translator about what she's hearing from the women being held at Cibola now and asked her if she's in contact with them.
Claro,
of course. I have received many letters when they ask for support. I have been receiving these since March. I've been hearing what's been going on, but part of the job is in the state of Arizona. So when I received the letters on Saturday, 29th of June, I realized everything that's going on with them.
Yeah.
Can you describe it for us a little bit? What are you hearing from the women who are there, and what are the conditions like?
Well, it moved me a lot. As of 2 months ago, I was hearing of an incapacitated person at the detention center in Cibola, where for 6 months she had diarrhea and she was told, we don't have medications. They don't put any importance on us for people suffering from HIV. And also, there's no way to sufficiently support the incapacitated, like in her case.
So are these typical of the challenges that transgender people face in detention? I know you were also in detention, right?
This, yes,
is correct in the way how ICE jails us and puts us in cells. I can't imagine everything. They are suffering, and the maltreatment verbally, physically, psychologically, from the officials and persons who work there, but also from those who find themselves detained.
So many of these people are also fleeing violence and persecution in their own countries, right? So when they get here, is it that much harder that they are then faced with challenges like this in detention by the government?
Well, I think and consider if a person is looking for better opportunities, I don't believe they can be treated that way or return to suffering maltreatment, like not having medications, be in conditions where the food is horrible, and also where there is mistreatment and abuse again, verbally and physically. Why would a human continue to live with this type of abuse?
Last question I have for you then is about what you would like to see change. Obviously, you're advocating for transgender women to not be held at all. If they have to be, what would you like to see change in terms of the treatment that they receive?
Okay, for me, I believe no one should be incarcerated or exposed to these types of inhuman conditions for simply wanting a better life and to have new opportunities in this life, the one we are living.
Nuevas oportunidades en esta vida.
Okay. Carla Bautista Chonet, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
When asked for comment on the handwritten letter, ICE spokesperson Leticia Zamaripa sent KJZZ an emailed statement saying that, quote, ICE cannot research or provide individual comment on allegations without specific details.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Tara Sprankle. I am one of the senior bird keepers here at the Phoenix Zoo, and I am one of the keepers that have been hand-raising the greater flamingos here at the zoo.
There you go. Oh my goodness.
Most of them are between 7.5 and 8 weeks old. They go for a swim every day in this large pool, which is great for their skin, for their feet, and it's a great way to beat the heat.
I'm Monica Yule, and I have been a keeper here for about 3.5 years. It's really important for elephants to stay cool in the summer. Reba came over and we were hosing her down with some cool water. Especially when it hits about 100 degrees, we like to come out here and help the elephants stay cool.
That's Tara Sprankle and Monica Yule cooling off elephants and baby flamingos at the Phoenix Zoo. And if you hear suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, send us the note, theshow@kjzz.org.
A Mesa police officer was pulled from duty this week after several female officers in the department came forward to accuse him of sexual harassment. They say the city and the department failed to discipline Officer Jeffrey Neese after they complained that he sent graphic sexual text messages. And at the same time, a 32-year-old female police officer for the Phoenix Police Department is suing for gender discrimination. Her suit describes how supervisors withdrew their approval of her transfer to a different squad after they found out she was pregnant. So what barriers do women face in policing? For more on that, I sat down with Katherine Anderson, founder and chair of the Women's Initiative Network, which works to recruit and mentor women in law enforcement. She is a retired police officer herself, a former deputy sheriff for Pima County, and she served 2 years on the Arizona Peace Officer Standards and Training Board. I asked her first if this surprises her at all. Like, how often do cases like this come up?
I don't have statistics about how often it comes up. I can tell you that we're probably not very different than any other male-dominated industry where women are still trying to overcome some of the barriers that we have been fighting ever since we were permitted to be in the industry and are still making our way. The fact that it's law enforcement and we have a voice and we are continuing to be in the spotlight, so to speak, just makes it that we are now front page on this topic.
Give us a little history. I mean, you mentioned there that women are allowed to be in the profession now. When did that happen?
So it actually happened in the early 70s, about 1972, which was the year I was born. So we're not even 50 years old in this profession. So it's still in its infancy.
Yeah, yeah. So give us a sense then. So you also have served with the Arizona Peace Officers Standards and Training Board. So I want to talk about what cities are supposed to do, what departments are supposed to do, what mechanisms are in place when issues like sexual harassment arise. What are the protocol?
So every agency has their own policies regarding police officer conduct. There's also the ethical standards of Arizona Post that every peace officer takes the oath to uphold. And while it doesn't specifically explain sexual harassment and not to do it, there is the conduct of officers that we uphold the oath to say, I will not do anything that disrupts the public trust in my ability to carry out my job. And so that's where I would assume that agencies would look to having sexual harassment behavior fall into.
I want to talk about then the culture around this. So women have not even, like you say, been in law enforcement for very long, been allowed to be in law enforcement for very long. So I wonder, in your experience and as you work with women in law enforcement now, which is still a small number of women, relatively, what are the challenges? What do they face?
So first of all, it is changing. It's a great time to be in law enforcement, and it is improving every day. There's so many more opportunities. There's so many more women interested. So in light of that, there are still barriers. There are still challenges. And the idea that we have still these situations that do happen are something that we have to talk about, we have to face. And as the leaders and the executives and the commanders of organizations, we have to be the ones that say this is a situation that we can't tolerate. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that does occur is when we see it happening, there's still some fear of calling it out. There's still some unwritten acceptance of the behavior because it's been there. Mm-hmm. But it is not acceptable. And the ability to call it out and put a stop to it in the workplace is something that there's still a reluctance to do.
That's still a challenge. Does that point to a culture problem or a slow kind of culture shift in law enforcement in terms of gender diversity?
It is. And so it's educating not just the fact that it's wrong and the fact that it's unacceptable, but then how do we call it out? How do we, as the people who are witnessing it, say to a counterpart that we have to trust out on the street to have our back in the most critical situations to say, I don't like what you said in there. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's right. And I don't want to hear it. It's an environment in which we have to create this unbreakable trust with somebody, but yet still hold them to the highest standards. And it really is this path that we have to walk, not just on a day-by-day basis, but literally a call-by-call basis.
Like we mentioned, there aren't very many women in law enforcement still. The most recent data that Pew Research Center had was from 2013, said 12% of full-time local police officers are women. That's just up from 8% in 1987. That's not a huge increase. So you work with women. You try to get women into law enforcement. You encourage them to take this path. How do you convince them that this is something that is worth it for them?
So here in the state of Arizona, we've actually faced that as well. A few years ago, we were at 10%, and we're actually now just ahead of the national average at about 13%. And we actually have agencies as high as 21%. Maricopa County Attorney's Office is blowing numbers away with 21%. And so what we do is, first of all, we look at the demographics of the areas that we serve. Maricopa County is 52% women. And so we want to recruit based upon the areas that we serve.
Why did you become a police officer?
So I left home very early. I left home at 16 and I joined the military. So I'm an Army vet, and I wanted stability. I wanted to know that I could take care of my family. I was a young mom. I had my daughter at 19, and I wanted to make sure that I could provide for her. And that's what law enforcement did for me. I actually wanted to become an FBI agent, but I came back to my home down in Tucson and joined the sheriff's department. I had a retirement. I am 47 years old, and I'm retired. I retired after 22 years with the department. I was able to get my education. I was able to have a life of adventure and challenge and raise a wonderful family, all because of the support and the stability, along with some very amazing adventures while giving back to my community. I love the service side that the department was able to give me.
So why has this become your mission to sort of promote other women in this field that just doesn't have very many?
So one of the stigmas that I found was that women historically had been pitted against each other. And I saw that in my career as well. And there's a sense of tokenism that if a woman was going for a position and there was already a woman in it, then she had to wait her turn. And I did not like that sense of tokenism. And I learned that there had to be a sisterhood created in order to really overcome this mentality that there was never going to be enough, that there was never enough room for all women.
So what do you hope comes of this work? Like, when and if you can get more women into law enforcement here, what difference do you hope it makes?
That there's equity for any woman who wants this career. And whether we ever achieve, 50-50 in this career, or we stay at 12%, it doesn't matter. The idea that any woman who enters this career has every opportunity to succeed without question is what we're after.
All right. Catherine Anderson is the founder and chair of the Women's Initiative Network. Catherine, thank you for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.